As we head into some of the busiest travel days of the year, we wanted to look back and remember what it was like for African Americans to travel during the years of segregation and the civil rights movement. Road travel was becoming more popular as cars became more affordable. But for Black Americans, traveling wasn't as easy as picking a destination and hitting the road, because in many places it was nearly impossible to find hotels, restaurants, even gas stations that would serve them. So a postal worker named Victor Hugo Green decided to start publishing a guide geared to Black travelers. He called it the Negro Motorist Green Book. Nicknamed the Green Book, it was published almost every year from 1936 to 1966. This year, the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture at New York Public Library digitized its collection, making the Green Books accessible to younger generations who've never seen them. Myra Liriano is chief librarian at the Schomburg Center, and she joins us from New York. Welcome, Myra.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
First of all, tell us a little bit about this man, Victor Hugo Green, and how did he get the idea for these books? I read that at least one of his inspirations was a Jewish friend who had a travel guide for avoiding restricted Gentile-only places.
So Victor Green was a postal worker, and when he got married in the teens, he and his wife moved to Harlem, even though he continued to work in New Jersey. And he himself traveled, and he knew people who traveled. And I think the idea came possibly from the Jewish press that would list places that were restricted for Jews. But I recently discovered another guidebook published in 1930, which also listed places where African Americans could go. Mostly it was hotels, places where they could stay in their travels. So a similar guide had been produced, and then from what I understand, it went bankrupt, so they weren't able to continue publishing it. So I think Victor Green probably got his ideas from a couple of different sources. Mm-hmm. But in 1936, he produced his first guidebook. It was very brief. It was just local, and it was highlighting businesses that would serve African Americans, whether it was sort of any kind of business that you could safely go to and travel to.
So it started just covering the New York metropolitan area, Manhattan and Westchester County, and it grew pretty fast to include other parts of the country, right?
Yeah. So the first couple of issues were local. Then by 1938, it was expanding to many states, kind of east of the Mississippi. And then by 1940, it pretty much represented the whole country. And by the late 40s, it was covering places internationally.
So the first 4 years, he managed to cover the entire country. Within a decade, he was covering overseas locations. How did one postman gather the research, or who helped him gather the research for all of these books?
From what I understand, Mr. Green was a very charismatic, dynamic man. He was also involved in the Postal Service Union, the National Association of Letter Carriers. From what I understand, his connections in the union, as well as the people that he met in Harlem. He managed his brother-in-law's music career. So his brother-in-law was a musician who also traveled. So I think he knew a lot of people that were in need of a guidebook like this.
So he had a lot of other postal carriers who he knew through the unions. Other postal carriers were collecting information for him along their routes and in their towns, right?
That is correct, yes.
Now, I understand that, you know, you look at these books and the color of the book is green. So it's not just his name that gave the books the Green Book. But the quote on the front of these books is just striking. It's the little motto in quotation marks that says, "Carry your Green Book with you. You may need it." Tell us about that. I mean, Jim Crow America, it's a time that some people alive still remember, but we're only 50 years on now from the passage of the Civil Rights Act. What was it like for Black Americans traveling in these towns, particularly some of these sundown towns that are described that people had to avoid, and these books helped them avoid those places?
So in this time, automobiles was becoming much more common for people to own. And I think what cars also allowed African Americans is sort of the freedom to travel in a way that they didn't have through public transportation because of Jim Crow laws. However, they ran into the problem where they couldn't stop just at any place. So during this time, there were, not just in the South, but many parts of even the North, gas stations that would not serve you, restaurants, hotels, the sundown laws made it dangerous to be out after dark. And if you're traveling with your family, you can imagine how difficult that would be to put your children and your family in danger in that way.
I'm reading in the 1949 edition a letter to the publisher that thanks him for the guide and notes that the Negro Motorist Green Book will mean as much, if not more, to us as the AAA book means to the white race. And one of the things that is listed in this edition and in many of these books is tourist homes as possible accommodations for travelers. Private people opening up their homes. It's kind of like an early Airbnb.
Yes, it is.
Why was that such an important staple of the Green Book?
Because many hotels would not serve African Americans, as well as gas stations. At this period in time, there was really only one company of gas stations, which was Esso, which is now known as ExxonMobil, that welcomed African Americans to their gas stations and to their rest stops. So you really had very limited options, but luckily African Americans understood this and opened up their homes for people to come and stay, even if they weren't necessarily an official, like, bed and breakfast, or, you know, it might have just been for to really serve their community.
I'm seeing that Mr. Green published photographs of African-American entrepreneurs, including owners of those Esso gas stations that you mentioned, and his books advise readers to serve as, quote, goodwill ambassadors of our race among those who perhaps are unfamiliar with us. And he specifically recommends New Mexico as a state where most motel keepers accept guests on the basis of cash, not color. Tell us about that.
One of the great advantages of having these guidebooks available for people to read through and study is that there were differences throughout the country. And, you know, I think some of these differences come through as you read through the guidebook itself. It kind of gives you those clues as to which places were friendly towards African Americans and which places were less friendly or more difficult or even dangerous to travel in.
I see here hotels, restaurants, gas stations, beauty parlors, nightclubs. You know, I'm also struck by what you mentioned about the overseas, because you can see the evolution of this book. By the early 1950s, you see the first guidebook, 1953's guide, has airplanes on the cover, and it's no longer called the Negro Motorist Book. Now it's the Negro Traveler's Guide. How common had air travel become for black families?
I think air travel was common just as it was for any American. I think people traveled, again, you know, for different reasons. If you think about it, you know, in the 50s, this is a big time for jazz, and you think of all those jazz musicians that you know traveled regularly to Europe and even other parts of the world. So you had actors and musicians and business people who traveled. I think that was becoming popular. And as families became more affluent, they would travel to go on vacation. So they would travel to places like Mexico and Bermuda, and even the last issue of the Green Book, which was the 1966-67, starts to highlight places even in Africa.
So Hugo Green said that his dream were for his guides to no longer be needed, for his company to go out of business. He died in 1960 before he could see that day. Tell us about when the last Green Book was published and why.
It was always his idea, and he mentions this kind of throughout his introductions of the Green Book, that there was the hope that someday this book would no longer be needed. And he actually writes something really wonderful, really beautiful in the introduction of the 1948 issue of the Green Book. And it goes, "There will be a day sometime in the near future when this guidebook will not have to be published. That is when we as a race will have equal opportunities and privileges in the United States. It will be a great day for us to suspend this publication, for then we can go wherever we please without embarrassment. But until that time comes, we shall continue to publish this information for your convenience each year." And then in 1966, the last issue that was published, there's a section on the Civil Rights Act of 1964. And it says, "The Civil Rights Act of 1964 is a new bill of rights for everyone, regardless of race, creed, or color. Effective at once, every hotel, restaurant, theater, or other facility catering to the general public must do exactly that." And so I think there was the recognition that by law you could not discriminate against African Americans and that they would be able to go to any hotel, restaurant, and so that the guidebook was no longer needed.
All right. The guidebooks are all available on the New York Public Library's website under the Schomburg Treasures. Your curators write about how you can click through these and see how the size of the world can change depending on the color of your skin. Myra Liriano, Chief Librarian at the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, thank you so much for joining us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.